Welcome to Come and Reason with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Tim Jennings. Together we will reason through complex issues to find evidence-based answers that harmonize scripture, science, and our life experiences. I'm your Come and Reason host, Charles Mills. This program is sponsored by Come and Reason Ministries. Welcome, everyone. For the past three programs, we've been listening in on a Tim Jennings presentation from a few years back on the subject of human sexuality. On today's broadcast, Dr. Jennings addresses the chemistry of sexual activity, and what you're about to hear may seem shocking, to say the least, but as is always the case on this program, what you're about to hear is also a combination of biblical truth and science. This program may not be suitable for very young children, but if you have teenagers under your influence, you might want to invite them to sit in with you to hear what the good doctor has to say on this vital and often misunderstood subject. He'll also include the answer to some questions submitted by a group of teenagers that he spoke to earlier. So open your mind and your heart, and let's listen.
So the chemistry of sexual activity. Let's look at the chemistry of sexual activity. Sexual activity in the foreplay stage, we're getting norepinephrine, we're getting increased energy, focus, muscle tension, heart rate's going up, blood pressure's going up, we're getting excitement, our breathing's getting faster, we're getting dopamine surge, we're getting this pleasure, we're having fun. This is exactly what cocaine does to our brain. But not only that, we get endorphins when we're having sex, we get these natural opiates, it creates a euphoria, high, it dilates the blood vessels, we eliminate pain, we feel good all over, which is exactly what heroin does. And we also get serotonin and GABA increases that cause a great sense of calm, a relaxation, a warm fuzzy all over, which is exactly what marijuana does. Now do you see why sexual addiction is difficult to overcome? So then why doesn't everybody get sexual addiction? Because during sex, in a loving, centered, other-centered relationship, large amounts of oxytocin is released, and oxytocin diminishes the tolerance neurobiologically in your brain. In the dopamine pathways, in the opioid pathways, and in the GABA circuitry, the oxytocin protects those circuits from adaptation that occurs when we use drugs of abuse. So you don't get tolerance, you don't get addiction. But without the oxytocin, then you can have that problem happen. And so sex as God designed it involves a physical touch, positive affirmation, trusting relationships, all which increase oxytocin. And then when it all climaxes in this huge dopamine surge, and the combination of both neurotransmitters together result in a powerful bonding experience without addiction. But oxytocin without dopamine, no bonding. And dopamine without oxytocin, no bonding. So sexual gratification without the high oxytocin increases our risk of sexual addiction. So what if sex with high anxiety, guilt, fear, like pornography, deviant behaviors, premarital sex, what's going to happen? What's the risk? Well, the high anxiety, the stress, the fear raises catecholamine levels. Catecholamine, stress hormones, what do they suppress? Oxytocin. Without oxytocin, having sex increases the risk of sexual addiction. This is why people get addicted to pornography. Or sex with naivety, infatuation, premarital sex, infatuation. Increase oxytocin with subsequent increase in bonding, selective memory, loss of healthy discrimination and judgment. You get this infatuated, overly attached, dependent, needy thing going on. And you can't reason and think anymore, and it doesn't matter what the person does, you still have this gooey-eyed thing because your oxytocin is like blurring your ability to actually remember anything of substance to make a healthy decision on. So sex and partner selection. Once sexually involved, we have increased dopamine and oxytocin, which the brain rewires. The brain with this combination actually rewires in such a way that the person that you're having sex with, the sensory stimulation from them, hearing their voice, seeing their face, touching them, seeing a picture of them, thinking about them, will cause more release in your reward pathways, your dopamine pathways, than any other person. So they can make you feel good. Just thinking about them, seeing their picture, hearing their voice, you feel good with them like no one else. Your brain rewires because of this oxytocin-dopamine combination. This results in less flexibility in partner selection, which is a good thing if you're married to the person. That's what you want. Okay? That's exactly how God designed it. It's not so good if you're like 16 and hadn't figured out things yet and who you're going to spend your life with. So premarital sex increases the risk of enhanced bonding to a non-spouse, Diminished discernment, discrimination, impaired judgment, selective amnesia, greater trust without evidence, greater emotional attachment. So you lose some of your autonomy and free will and become more bonded in a chemical way to somebody you might not ultimately want to be with. And this is what happens when a lot of people have this sexual activity. They end up marrying people, and later down the road, as things don't work out and the stress hormones start rising because of the constant conflict and fighting, the oxytocin eventually wears off and they really much hate each other, because they didn't take their time to actually develop a love relationship first. Greater pain at the loss of the relationship if we had this premarital sex going on. So you have premarital sex and your relationship ends, it's more painful emotionally because these oxytocin bonding thing has to rewire. Greater pain diminishes the oxytocin. So in the next relationship, unless there's time for healing. So if you've been sexually active and your partner breaks up with you and your relationship ends, you got this severe pain and you just bounce right into another relationship, the pain that you're still suffering from the first one is diminishing oxytocin release, so it impairs your ability to bond to the next person you're with. So even if you're sexually active with the next person, you don't have as close a bond as you would have had if you would have waited and allowed your brain to rewire and heal from the first relationship. This results in increased risk of sexual addiction. So benefits of abstinence until marriage. Well, we think more clearly. We make better assessments before we chemically bond and neurologically rewire our brain to someone. Better sex and more intense bonding when you do marry. It's better. Avoid higher levels of emotional pain if the relationship does fail. And avoid the risk of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, in pregnancy. Avoid damage to our conscience and the guilt and the fear cascade that we talked about. Decrease risk of sexual addiction. If previously sexually active, if you've been previously sexually active and you're not married, allow time for the neural circuits to reset, i.e. singleness and sexual abstinence before going out and dating and getting involved again. Allow your time to heal. So that's kind of the overview of all the neurobiologic stuff. And now we're going to go into the questions with this as our background and our foundation to be able to pull from to answer the questions. Some of them are just data questions. This is one of them. What percentage of teens have sex? According to this particular survey, which is a youth risk behavior surveillance, 32% of 9th graders, 43% of 10th graders, 55% of 11th graders, and 64% of 12th graders across the United States have had sex. Youth risk behavioral surveillance. Statistics on teen sexual activity and ethnicity in high school, 34% of teen girls in the United States become pregnant at least once before the age of 20. 1 in 3. Now, get this. Teen pregnancy in the U.S. is 10 times that of Japan, 4 times that of France and Germany, and twice that of Great Britain. And you know what the punchline is, right? Yet the U.S. has the highest percentage of Christians than any of these other countries. What does that tell you? Just say no doesn't work. We have to change their beliefs. And we're not giving them the beliefs. And I'm going to tell you something else. I think we're giving our kids a God that they're afraid of. And that impairs healthy bonding to God and the help that they would need to overcome some of these temptations. The majority of the teens, those teens who had sex, the majority, 60% overall and 67% among the younger adolescents, regret their first experience and wish they'd waited. So take a lesson from teens who've been there. Most of them think this was bad. They didn't want to do it. They regretted it and wish they wouldn't have done it. Another question. Why are people having sex younger and younger these days? Why do teens feel they have to have sex when they're in high school? We form a lot of false beliefs based on watching television programming and media, such as everyone's doing it, so I must be weird not to. We have to replace a false belief like that with a truth. And the truth would be, I don't care who else is doing it, I'm wise not to. That's the truth. False belief, there's no harm. Truth, there is harm. You've seen the data, there's a lot of harm. False belief, it's what you do when you love someone. What's the truth? What's the truth? It's what you don't do if you love someone outside of marriage. Because if you love someone, you want to protect them. You don't want to exploit them. Media influences alter brain development. I didn't mention this in the earlier, but when a child comes into the world, the child has at birth, an infant, hundreds of millions of neurons, more at birth than that brain, that child's brain has by the time they're 8 years of age. First 8 years of life, the brain is busy killing off brain cells by the hundreds of millions. Now, at first that doesn't sound too good, but conceptualize it like this. Michelangelo's block of marble when Michelangelo gets it, and Michelangelo's block of marble when he's done with it. When Michelangelo is done, doesn't he have less marble? But he has a masterpiece. Our brain comes into the world prepared to be acted upon by education, environment, experience, neural circuits which are exercised or expanded and retained, neural circuits which are not being used, the brain will delete. Thus, you've probably all heard of tragic situations of children which were locked in cages. No one ever spoke any language to them. They are discovered and rescued at age 12, 13, 14. They can never learn to speak language correctly. Maybe 50 or 100 word vocabulary is all they can develop. Because the neural circuits that correspond to language were not used, the brain either reassigned them or deleted them. Well, this happens through the brain. Understanding that process of normal brain development, exercising neural circuits, keep them, not exercising them, don't develop them or delete them. Theatrical television watching. Theatrical television watching has the primary purpose of activating the limbic system while simultaneously turning off the prefrontal cortex. So the more TV kids watch during the developmental years, the more development of the limbic system, the less development of the prefrontal cortex. And so when they hit adolescence and the hormones hit, they have all this irritability, this moodiness, these impulses that they cannot process and control with their prefrontal cortex. And so they act out aggressively, irritably, often sexually, and will often turn to alcohol and drugs to calm a limbic system their prefrontal cortex can't calm. So television watching not only changes belief systems, it actually changes the normal development of a brain so they're more prone to be impulsive and less able to restrain themselves in adolescence. Divorce. The studies are very clear. Families in which there is divorce, the kids are more prone to have sex at an early age. So if families can work out their differences and avoid divorce, but that doesn't mean that if you're in a situation where, you know, somebody's molesting one of the kids in the home, one of the parents is molesting one of the kids, well, the one who's not needs to separate that situation. So it doesn't mean divorce should never happen. But if you can work it out and keep the kids safe, then it's going to help protect them. Low parental monitoring or low parental rules or coercive homes. So let's go through each of those. So if you have a home in which the parents don't really monitor or have any real rules, that will increase early onset of sexual activity. Or homes in which there is excessive coercive control, then that also causes rebellion and early sexual activity. Permissive parental attitudes. That would be parents may have rules, but they also say, hey, it's okay. You know, we did it, we were early, you guys go ahead and have fun. Permissive parental attitudes would connote an idea that it's okay. And then genetics. Believe it or not, studies show that the age in which you were first sexually active as a parent predicts very closely the age your kids will be first sexually active. And this has to do with the genes that control impulsivity. Impulsivity. And so we have the inability to restrain our impulses, and we get those sexual impulses, we have a difficult time restraining them. And so parents who have impulse control problems will often have kids with impulse control problems. We can make those worse by having a lot of television watching during the developmental years, and we don't develop the prefrontal cortex, which self-governs and restrains, we can have our kids that are even more impulsive than we might have been.
Well, yes, I know that's the fastest 15 minutes on earth, but we'll be back and we'll pick up right from this spot on our next broadcast. So I invite you to tune in and join us and learn more about human sexuality as presented by Dr. Tim Jennings in this presentation that we are now providing on this broadcast. CommonReason.com is the website. Lots of resources there for you to enjoy, including these podcasts if you'd like to share them with someone. That's all at CommonReason.com. This program was sponsored by Come and Reason Ministries. And until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Dr. Tim Jennings wishing you God's presence in your life. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for spending time with us today. To continue the journey, I urge you to visit comeandreason.com. Here you'll find many excellent resources to help you gain a deeper understanding of the God we all love and serve. That's at comeandreason.com. This is Charles Mills, along with Dr. Tim Jennings, inviting you to join us the next time we come and reason together.